Hey, Mac Geeks, it's Adam. I just wanted to give you a quick program note on this episode. I had some technical difficulties on this one, and it actually posted a day past the actual date. It was recorded on November 30th, but you're getting it in your feed on December 1st. I just wanted to clarify that just in case you noticed and didn't want anybody to think that there was something wrong with your feed. So here you go. Here's the November 30th MacCast. MacCast, Friday, November 30th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Sorry it's been a little while since we chatted. We had the Thanksgiving holiday here in the U.S. last week, and I hadn't really planned on taking some time off, but with family and just the holiday schedule kind of kicking off, you know, things got a little bit nuts, and I decided that I was just going to let it go that week, and I'm glad I did, because I'm feeling much more refreshed and ready to get back into the swing of things. But consequently, that means that we have lots of stuff to talk about. So this is going to be a big feature-packed episode, lots of new things going on, the new iMacs coming out, new iTunes hitting the streets, and we're going to dive into all of that stuff here in a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick second and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, Notebook's a great application for taking notes and organizing your thoughts and ideas and stuff like that. And one of the things to me that makes it really powerful is the fact that it uses this metaphor of a physical notebook. So if you think about it just like you would a three-ring binder, you can put anything in there that you might put into a physical binder, including included documents and stuff like that. And specifically, I'm talking about PDFs and images. You can throw those into your notebooks, and then you can use the tools that are built in Notebook, the additional note tools, of course, to take notes about what you're organizing, but also drawing tools and annotation tools to mark up those documents. So if you want to make some references to certain parts of PDF or maybe throw some sticky notes on there, you can do that, and you can put that all in place. You can, of course, access the original document, have it open up in another application like Preview, but you can go back and forth and you can work with that, and you can almost use it like a document organizer as well. So I like to think of it as notebooks for specific projects. I have different notebooks for projects that I'm working on, and then you can divide stuff into sections. So for MacCast research, I have a little research notebook, and I can clip items into different sections, whether it's going to be tips for the show or news items, if it's related to iPhones or iMacs. I can kind of organize those sections and move things around, and it all gets indexed and stuff like that. So it's a great tool for staying organized and doing research as well. And they also have a version for the iPad that has Dropbox support. So if you store all your notebook documents in Dropbox, you can bring those into the iPad version and you can take your documents with you. So it's just a very powerful and very versatile application. It's been around for years. It is great, and you should check it out. They have free trials available on the website. And while you're over at the website, you should also check out their new application, iTrash, which brings some nostalgia back to your Mac. It lets you put your trash can back on the desktop like it used to be in the old days, and even lets you do customization. They've got cool customized trash icons with sound and animation, so it adds a little bit of fun back into your Mac. So along with getting your business tool of Notebook, you can get a little fun application at the same time, all over at circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So just barely beating their self-imposed deadline, Apple did ship the 21.5-inch new iMac models to stores, and they also made them available for sale on the website starting today, November 30th. So you can now go online and pick up a shiny new iMac. You might have to wait a couple days, though. They're pretty popular. The pictures started showing up actually a day earlier in the U.S. than expected, and not really a day earlier than expected, because we started seeing images show up from Australia, and of course, you folks down under are a day ahead of us here in the States. And so what was immediately obvious was that the new iMac comes in a funky new box. It's kind of this tapered trapezoidal shape, so it's fatter at the base and narrower at the bottom, and the whole thing kind of flops open so you can just slide the iMac out. It looks like it's very accessible in terms of getting it out, and you no longer have to kind of reach down in there and lift it straight up. I'm half wondering if some people had some issues where they'd be taking them out of the box and dropping them, because they were pretty heavy. Now the new ones are about 8 pounds lighter, so should also be easier and just moving it around and setting it up. But reviews are starting to come in on both the 21.5-inch and the 27-inch model. The 27-inch model won't be here until December, but some review sites have received them already. And one comment that seems to be pretty common is that even though it's still a glossy screen, just as Apple promised, there is a lot less glare. It has reduced glare. Apple claims it's 70% less glare. It still uses the same IPS technology and resolution as the prior generation models, but the big difference here is Apple is now laminating the LCD and glass layers together, so you don't have that separation, and there's a new anti-glare technology that's put on there. So it's supposed to look a lot better. A lot of the reviews are saying because you have basically the LCD pixels pushed right up against the glass, that it really makes text and images pop. They almost feel like they're jumping out of the screen. So I'm curious to get into my local Apple store and take a look at that and see how much more noticeable the quality of the display is, even though they haven't really changed the underlying technology, but it's supposed to look better. The other thing about the new iMac is that at the edge, at least, it is incredibly thin. And actually, overall, I don't think is any thicker in the middle than the prior generation, but it tapers kind of at an extreme curve toward the edge, which is just 5 millimeters thick. Now, the bulge in the back is about 4 times thicker than it is at the edge, so still not very thick. And of course, that means that Apple had to remove some technologies to kind of get that thinness, most noticeably the optical drive. So no optical drive in the new model. And another thing that I think is a little bit of a disadvantage is that the SD card slot had to be moved around to the back, because there really is physically no place to put it on the side of the machine. So if you use that on your iMac now, if you have one of the models that has that, it's going to be a little bit more difficult to use. And along with that SD card slot, Apple did do a nice update to the ports. You've got 4 USB 3 ports, 2 Thunderbolt ports, and then the gigabit Ethernet along with your audio out. Now, one thing I noticed at the launch event and also with the marketing images on Apple's website is they were very smart and clever about how they shot pictures of the iMac, because they showed all the best sides and none of the bad sides. They completely left out showing that back bulge that it has. And the other thing that I immediately noticed when review images started showing up is that it's got some serious vent holes on the back that you can't see. Apple actually did, from a design standpoint, a pretty clever job of hiding them right behind the stand on the back of the display. So sort of right under where the stand connects to the back of the display, there are a bunch of big slots, vent slots, for the fan. And I believe, I haven't seen it in person yet, but I believe if it works the same way as the current generation Macs, those pull in air from the top and sort of blow the air out the bottom. In this case, it pulls it in just under that stand through those large vent holes and then push them out the bottom. There's actually some very big vent holes underneath the front edge of the display, right down there at the bottom of the chin. And also down there is still a pair of stereo speakers. They're downward facing, but The Verge noted that they sound good, but not as good as the prior generation models, specifically in the bass response. And that probably makes sense because they don't have a lot of room to get any sort of bass movement in a speaker there. I would imagine the speakers were small before. I don't know if the ones in the new one are smaller or different than the prior generation models, but there's nothing to reverberate. There's sort of no air to get any kind of bass response in there. So that didn't really surprise me when they made that comment, but just something to be aware of. I think most people with desktop Macs are going to go with a set of AirPlay speakers or some sort of external speakers if you want to get really good sound. I don't know that anybody ever really expects good audio from their little computer speakers. But let's get to the important parts of these reviews, and that is the performance. How do these compare to the prior generation models? Well, Primate Labs did some speed tests on the top-of-the-line 21.5-inch model. That has a 3.1 gigahertz Core i7 processor, and they found that it was actually 10% faster in benchmark scores than the old high-end 27-inch iMac. That was the one with the 3.4 gigahertz Core i7. So a slightly slower clocked i7, but it uses the newer Ivy Bridge processor technology, which results in that performance bump. As far as how it compared to the high-end 21.5-inch model, so the one that it was replacing, actually turned out to be 25% faster in benchmark scores. Now, I will point out that these are benchmark scores, so your actual performance increase when you're using it on a day-to-day basis is going to vary. But if past history holds true, in general, when Apple revs their machines, I think you see anywhere, depending upon the task, a 10 to 20% jump in real-world performance. Like I said earlier, if you want a 27-inch model iMac for the holidays, you might be out of luck or fast running out of luck. Wait times on the U.S. store already have a published ship time of 3 to 4 weeks. We're not really sure when they're going to be coming out in December. I think when they originally hit the store, though, they were at a 2 to 3 week wait time. They don't have a ship date, so Apple's just said sometime in December. If you want a 21.5-inch model, though, you can pick those up. When I currently checked today, it was on a 1 to 3 business day ship time. So at the moment, availability looks pretty good. I think some of the in-store reports are saying it's kind of hit or miss on whether or not you can walk into an Apple retail store and pick one up. But just keep an eye on your local store, and you probably can get your hands on one if you need to. Apple also just barely missed their already delayed deadline for iTunes 11. Just a day before the end of November, they did finally give us iTunes 11. It is a big revamp of iTunes, completely redone, a whole new user interface, tons of new features in there, some removed features. So I thought we'd go through some of the changes. If you haven't already downloaded it, or if you're a little bit leery about it, maybe this will give you some insight into what you can expect. The biggest thing you're going to notice right away as far as new features is that it has a new single window view. There's no longer the three-column or multi-column layout with the sidebars, either the standard library sidebar or the Genius sidebar that's over there on the right. Now you just get a big single window with all of your libraries accessible from a little drop-down menu. I think when you first launch it, it defaults to your music library, but there's a little drop-down there. Still does have the colored icons in there, so if you were worried about that, they didn't pull a finder switch on you and remove the colored icons, so you can drop those down. You got your music and your podcasts and your movies and TV shows. They're all in there. You're just not going to see them in a sidebar, at least not by default. Also, a lot of the metadata columns tend to be suppressed in the list views, but they're all there. Don't worry. You can access them under the view menu if you want to turn them back on. And there is no simple list view, though, for some views, like the artist view, for example. You get the album list view, and you don't have any options to change that. So that's a little bit frustrating, or probably could be a little bit frustrating for certain users. When you get into the individual libraries, you'll notice there are tabs for different categories and sections, and you can play around with it. The key thing that I'll tell you is that if you're looking for something, if you're looking for some sort of information that seems to be missing, first place to check is that view menu. There's a lot of options. Check out the view options and see what you have available. Apple did simplify it just in terms of the default views, but a lot of the stuff can still be turned back on. The other thing that you're going to notice right away is there are lots and lots of popover menus. They really are not doing dialog boxes too much anymore. There still are some old school dialog boxes, but a lot of the new functionality is going to happen when you click on something. You get sort of that little pop out dialog, almost like a little speech bubble, and then you get additional functionality. Something that some people are going to either like or hate is the stoplight buttons, the little red, yellow, and green window buttons, those now are restored to their original normal functions. Clicking on the little green icon no longer puts you into the mini player. There is a whole new mini player button for that over on the right-hand side of the interface up toward the top next to the full screen button. So you click on that and you'll get the new mini player. Album view is completely redone. It has this new thing called expanded view. So when you click on an album, it actually slides open to reveal the individual tracks. It looks very much like folders in iOS. So if you're familiar with that, you're going to be familiar with the kind of animation. One really cool thing that they did there, and I'd love to know how they worked out this technology, is they have some sort of algorithm that will sample the background color from your album art, and actually I think also some of the additional colors to set the background and the text colors for the expanded view. So it looks really nice. They've got the album art over on the right and the track list, and it's all color matched to be similar to the album art, which looks incredible and is really smart way to do that thing. When you're in that view, you also get a couple toggles. There's song view and then an in the store view. If you go to the end of the store view, this kind of replaces a lot of the Genius sidebar or the store sidebar information stuff. It slides your track list over and then you get your store recommendations right there in the expanded view on the right-hand side. The store is integrated throughout, so within the little pop-up menus and things like that, there is lots of opportunity for Apple to market and push you toward recommendations in the Apple Store. What's nice about them doing it this way is it doesn't, even though it's there and persistent, I noticed when I was using it, doesn't feel overly selly like some other solutions from other vendors and other stores and stuff like that. It's pretty subtle, but it is there, so that may be off-putting to a few people, but it didn't really bother me too much. And I think one of the things that they've done is because it's so tightly integrated, you can do things like make purchases without even having to leave your library. So you can purchase right there. You don't have to leave the expanded view, the iTunes store view and the expanded view. Another big new feature, and this is one of my favorite ones, is what they call the Up Next list. And so up there, when you're playing a track by the playhead and the progress bar and stuff like that, your player controls, there is an Up Next button. And if you're playing on shuffle, I like to play my music on shuffle a lot, or even as you're going through an album, you can click on that and you can see what tracks are coming up next. You can reorganize them. You can add to the next play list. And this is a feature that pretty much is just like the old iTunes DJ party shuffle mode. And now if you're saying, well, what the heck is that? I think that's exactly the point, is Apple's brought this sort of view and this functionality more front and center. You can discover it much more easily because it was a really cool feature. And I think just a lot of people didn't use it. So now it's right there. It's easy to access. You can click the little list icon to see what's coming up next, or you can just hover over the currently playing song in the now playing header and it will pop up for you. The mini player is also incredible. I think it is hands down my favorite new feature. It now is its own window, which is a little bit interesting. So you can click the little mini player button, like I was saying, and it will pop down the mini player, and that toggles between the main iTunes view and the mini player. But if you go into the window menu and turn on the mini player, you can now have the mini player and the main iTunes window open at the same time. So that's a significant change. But in the mini player, what you get is you get the album art along with the currently playing track info. And then when you hover over the mini player, then it pops open the controls. Now, one thing that I do, I have my mini player squished down as small as it could go. And I knew that another big feature of the mini player was the fact that you didn't have to jump back into the main iTunes library to grab additional tracks or to do a search or to access the next up list. But I didn't see it when I minimized my player, and that's because you can actually minimize it so that those two bits of functionality, is the search icon and the next playing icon, disappear. So I just had to widen it a little bit. So if you run into that, do that. But you can now access that stuff and it will pop up. And you can add items to the next up playlist. You can also add items to any playlist without leaving the mini player. So you have most of the functionality that you can get to from your main music library right there. And that makes it really powerful and really convenient. I should mention also that overall the design, everything is a lot flatter. It's more sleek. I actually really like the interface. A couple caveats, though, and I've made this complaint against some of the stuff that Microsoft is doing with sort of flattening the interface. It's not always obvious what sorts of things are clickable. So as you're trying to edit track information, sometimes I found that I could click on the title of a track and it would turn into an editable box, and in other instances, it wouldn't do anything. So it can be a little bit confusing, but I think I will get used to it over time. But you just might notice that as you're playing around with sort of the flatter interface. Also, another thing that's going to take a little bit of getting used to is some of the older functionality and controls, as I was saying earlier, are there, but they're just a little bit more hidden. The sidebar being one of those things. I'm going to tell you how to get that back here in a second. But another one on the mini player that I noticed was missing almost immediately was the volume control. The volume control is not there down at the bottom anymore. You actually have to access it through the AirPlay icon. So you click on the AirPlay icon, you'll see all of your AirPlay speaker options, which is nice, and you can even send audio to multiple speakers. You could do that before, but again, it's much more discoverable now because you click that little pop-up and it's all there. But right there at the top, it has the volume sliders, and you can also control individual volumes for multiple speaker AirPlay speakers if you've got your audio sending to multiple locations. So that's all really cool. There also is a little clock icon you'll notice in the mini player, and that accesses a new feature, which is your play history. It's actually part of the next up list, so you can actually access it from the next up list in the main library as well. But you click on that icon, and it will show you the previously played tracks, and you can go back through in case you missed something. So that's really handy. If you heard a song and it jumped to the next song, and you're like, oh, what was the song it was just playing? You can go back and review that and access that history. Streaming and iCloud is now integrated very well, much more accessible. You can stream your purchased movie and TV shows right inside iTunes. They will show up in your library with a little iCloud download icon next to them, so you'll be able to immediately tell stuff that's local versus stuff that's not local. You don't have to jump over to the App Store to the purchase section to go access that stuff. It's right in your library now. Devices are also in a little pop-up menu. So if you, because there's that sidebar isn't there by default, if you need to access your attached or your Wi-Fi connected iOS devices, they'll show up there under the devices list. You click on that, and then clicking on an individual device will pop up the sort of standard, or load into the main interface, the standard device screen. So you can go in and you can access the different tabs and stuff like that for setting up how you want to do your syncing preferences and your device preferences. There's a store button, which is replaced by a library button when you're in the store. So it's sort of a toggle mode now, where you click on the store, it jumps over to the store, and then there's a button there that lets you click to jump back to your music library. It feels a lot more seamless in terms of moving between the store and your library, and there's just subtle visual cues. Of course, the design looks a lot different. It doesn't look like your music library, but it's still all happening in the same full window. And without the sidebars, it's taking me a little while to get used to. There is a change that happens to the main sort of menu bar. It changes from a light gray to a dark gray when you're in the store. So you can tell, hey, I'm in the store now and I'm browsing for music versus I'm in my library and I'm looking at the stuff that I've purchased or I own. Really cool feature that I haven't had a chance to try out yet, but I'm probably going to go buy an iTunes gift card just to try this. You can now redeem gift cards in the store by simply scanning the redemption code with your FaceTime camera. So it's using some OCR or something like that, and it'll be able to read the code. So no longer having to enter those cryptic codes is going to be really nice. It'll be interesting to see how well that feature works. And one interesting little note that was pointed out by John Gruber with respect to the resolution, it does look like the new iTunes is optimized in certain instances for Retina displays, most noticeably in the little icon for the next up list. I guess if you're on a non-Retina Mac, what you get is just a little list with kind of little bullet points next to it on the icon. In Retina Macs, you can actually see little 1, 2, 3 numbers on the list. There's actually numbers there, not just little dots. And of course, that's enabled by the high resolution of that display. You can see those tiny little numbers in there. As I promised, I'll tell you how to get your sidebar back. So if you look at the new interface, and I would encourage you to try the new interface. I've been using it for just about a day or so now, and I actually really like it. I'm adapting very, very quickly. I don't think there's a large learning curve. I like not having the sidebars there because I think it just makes everything cleaner, and I'm not missing them. But if you are missing them, you can go under the View menu, and there is a Show Sidebar option. Another thing that you might miss is the little bar down at the bottom that would give you the number of songs in your library, things like the current playlist, how long it's going to take to play all your songs, if you were playing all of them, how much disk space they're using. That isn't on by default anymore either. They're sticking with sort of one window interface. If you'd like to get that back, that is the status bar, and you can also turn that on from the View menu. Something that you might notice immediately when you go into the movie library now is there is a brand new media type under movies called Home Movies. And if you look at that section of your library right after installing iTunes 11, there's probably going to be nothing in there. You actually need to assign new category to your videos in order to get stuff to show up there. So if you go into your movies and select a movie that is a home movie, choose File, Get Info, and then go to the Options tab, you can change the media kind from movie to home movie, and that will move it to that part of your library. Click OK to finish, and it'll jump it over there. So I did this for mine, and it's kind of nice because you can now separate sort of your home videos from the commercial videos and stuff that maybe you ripped or that you purchased from iTunes. One odd thing that was pointed out by a number of reviewers like John Gruber and Dan Morin is that the dialogue boxes have not all been updated. There are instances as you go through where they still revert back to the old iTunes 10 style dialog boxes, and it does look visually jarring. I think Apple's going to have to go through and clean those up. It was probably just a time thing. They sort of prioritized which windows and stuff they wanted to update. And the Get Info window is a great example. So if you want to see what I'm talking about, just select any file within your iTunes library or any item within your iTunes library and do a File, Get Info, and you'll see that old style dialog box. So what has been removed? What is missing? Well, you'll probably notice some of these things right away. One of the big ones is CoverFlow is no longer a view option. So if that was one of your favorite views, you may not want to upgrade to 11. I never really use that view too much, so personally, I don't think I'm going to miss it. A feature that is gone that I am going to miss terribly, and I've already had many of you tell me that you're missing it as well, is the Find Duplicates feature. And I noticed almost right away that within iTunes Match, I had somehow ended up with some duplicate files. You still have the duplicate functionality of iTunes Match, but it's not that easy to find those duplicates now without that Find Duplicate view. So I don't know if Apple will bring that back or if we're going to have to rely on third-party tools, but that is one that I definitely miss. The iTunes DJ feature is gone, but I don't think that, one, many people use that, and also, as I was saying earlier, most of its functionality has been duplicated by the new Next Up list, and so you can do a lot of the same things. The Genius sidebar is gone, but again, a lot of the Genius sidebar features with respect to pointing you towards like content in the music store, that's all there in the expanded views and also through the Genius recommendation pop-up menu. I actually prefer it that way because now if you want to access that stuff, it's there, but when you don't need it or if you don't want to be bothered by it, it's not visible, it's not there, and you don't have to be bothered with it. Now, one thing that I noticed and discovered that I think was a piece of functionality, it's amazing how quickly you forget, that was in iTunes 10, is it seems now like I can't send audio from a movie or a video that I'm playing over to a set of AirPlay speakers. You have to send the audio and video together. And I thought before I could actually play a movie on my Mac and then send the audio to my AirPlay speakers, but I couldn't figure out how to do that in iTunes 11. If that functionality is still there and you've discovered how to make it work, let me know. Shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. And that's pretty much the basics of iTunes 11. I'm sure we're going to be getting into some of the tips and tricks as we learn more about it and some of its quirks and stuff like that on future episodes. If you discover anything cool or interesting about iTunes 11, certainly send along an email and let us know about it. In conjunction with the release of iTunes 11, Apple did update the remote application for iOS. Remote app version 3.0 came out. It supports the new Up Next features. The iPad version actually has a version of that expanded view for albums, including that cool sort of matching the color of the album art stuff. So it looks gorgeous. The new remote app is really, really nice. I recommend that you grab that update if you haven't already. And several sites have already pointed out that the app looks and works way better than the music app on the iPad. And that may just provide a hint as to the kind of update we can expect now that Sir Johnny is in charge of the UI and the design team over there for iOS apps and the iOS operating system itself. I have a feeling we're going to get much more of this flat look. And if the new music app for the iPad looks and works like the remote app, that is going to be awesome. I think there'll be a lot of very happy people out there, myself included. And then there was also a firmware update for the Apple TV, a firmware version 5.1.1 for the second and third generation Apple TVs. It does have some security updates and some bug fixes, but most importantly, brings support for the new iTunes 11. So if you have a second or third generation Apple TV, you probably want to run software update on that and grab the latest firmware if you've upgraded to iTunes 11. And so the end of the month has been a busy time for Apple. Apple is also now offering US customers a fully unlocked GSM iPhone 5 through their website. The off-contract phone will set you back $649, $749, or $849 for a 16GB, 32GB, or 64GB model, respectively. So not cheap to get an unlocked device off contract, but you won't be on contract, and you can take that thing wherever you'd like, put out whatever SIM you want in there. So that is really good news for international travelers. Now, if you want to save a little bit of money, probably your best option is to go with an on-contract Verizon iPhone 5. Those are actually already SIM unlocked out of the box. So you will have the contract, but you can also take it overseas and travel with it and just pop in an additional SIM. So just something to consider. But if you want to buy a fully unlocked one, you can now get that through Apple's website. An interesting aside related to iPhone updates, in iTunes 11, it was discovered that there are actually references that seem to indicate future support for a 128GB iPhone model. There's been speculation for a while that Apple may bump up the storage sizes on the iPhone at some point. Some people are thinking that maybe in the first quarter we'll see an update, considering that that is classically when we would see a bump in the iPads, but having the iPads just revved last month, maybe we'll see something more along the lines of an iPhone update, maybe an iPad mini update in the spring. Who knows? But of course, anytime Apple makes little tweaks or puts little hints inside a software update, it gets the rumor mills a-buzzing. The iPhone 5 and the iPad mini will also be coming to China beginning in December. The Wi-Fi iPad mini will go on sale in the region on December 7th, according to Apple. Apple also recently just received approval for the iPhone 5 on the China Unicom network. That's China's third largest carrier. And so the iPhone 5 is expected to arrive a week after the iPad mini in the region on December 14th. So that should be a big bump in iPhone 5 sales for Apple. China is a huge, huge market, and even being on the third largest carrier would be a big deal. Of course, there's hope and speculation that Apple will be on the other carriers in the region soon as well. Back in the US, however, iPhone sales are doing quite well. As a matter of fact, over the past 12 weeks, Apple was able to regain the top spot in US smartphone sales. The iPhone 5 beat Android devices, garnering a 48.1% share of the US smartphone market. Android had 46.7%. As the availability of the iPhone 5 gets better, it's expected that Apple should be able to hold the lead at least for a little while. Outside the US, though, Android still dominates. In Germany, the Google smartphone accounted for 73.9% of sales, and over in Italy, they account for a whopping 81.7% of the market. So the iPhone 5 is in the lead currently in the US, but globally they're still losing out to just the influx of Android devices. Same sort of thing is going on the tablet front. Android is continuing to take hold. Apple still is in the lead, but that lead is certainly slipping. Abbey Research reports that Apple's iPad saw a sequential decline of about 14% in global tablet market share in the third quarter. The iPad accounted for 55% of the market. Android tablets, on the other hand, saw a very large year-over-year gain, 44%. For the same period, and that was likely brought on by the introduction of tablets like the Nexus 7, the Kindle HD, and the new Nook devices. So Apple is just probably not going to win that game in terms of sheer sales numbers, but as we've talked about on the MacCast in the past, it's not all about unit sales numbers. There is a big difference between selling a lot of units and actually making money from those units. And as far as that game goes, Apple is dominating, and we don't see the competitors with their lower priced tablets catching up anytime soon. And as sort of an illustration of that, there is a report from App Annie, which is a company that does analytics for about 40% of the top 100 App Store publishers, and that's both Apple App Store and Google's App Store. They showed that Apple's app revenues for October were actually four times that of the revenues generated by Google's Play Store. The study also noted, though, that while Apple was top in terms of total revenue, their growth rate month over month is starting to flatten. Comparing revenues for October 2012 versus January of 2012, the study found that revenue for Apple was just up about 12.9%, just about 13% over that time frame. And when looking at just the revenues from September to October, they actually noted that Apple saw about a 0.7% decline in terms of app revenue. For that same period, or for those same time points, the Google Play Store saw an amazing amount of growth. From January 2012 to October 2012, they saw a revenue increase of 311%. And it's not just incredible revenue growth that Google is seeing. They're also seeing them catch up in just in terms of sheer downloads of number of apps. A lot of this probably brought on by the sheer number of Google devices that are out there. Google saw downloads increase 48% from May 2012 to October 2012. Over the same period, Apple's downloads increased just 3.3%. So what does all this mean? Well, actually not very much. What it proves is that Google is seeing rapid exponential growth in their app marketplace, but you have to remember their app marketplace is developing. It's very much like Apple. It's very much now like Apple's marketplace was years ago. Apple's already gone through that exponential growth, and they have a much more mature store that has plateaued. So that's sort of what you would expect to see. And after this report came out, Apple was actually quick to retort, because how you present the numbers can make a significant difference in the message that you're delivering. Apple pointed out that year over year revenue growth for the App Store is actually up 200%. And the main difference here is that Apple is looking at year to year, whereas the App Annie report was comparing specific months, specifically January 2012 to October 2012. And those numbers tell a very different growth picture. Bottom line is that stats can be tweaked to tell whatever story that you want, and you always need to take these reports with a grain of salt. No matter what, though, a mature Apple app marketplace and a growing Google Play marketplace mean a lot of opportunity for developers. And at the end of the day, that likely means apps for both stores being developed, and good apps at that. And that is good for the general app marketplace as a whole and for us as consumers. Apple does continue to dominate, though, in terms of actual usage of devices and revenue numbers. A study from IBM of post-Thanksgiving online purchases showed that Apple devices dominated mobile sales. Overall, mobile purchases accounted for about 25% of post-holiday online shopping. Simcoe took the numbers, analyzed them, and their study found that 77% of mobile purchases were actually made on an iOS device. The iPad surprisingly, accounted for 10% of all online shopping purchases. The iPhone was 8.7% of all online shopping purchases, and Android devices came in at 5.5%. The important thing to note about the Android number is that is all Android devices combined. So any tablet, any smartphone running Android came in at 5.5%, and that's impressive when you consider that 10% of all online purchases came from just the iPad, so about double the Android devices. So it does make you wonder, what are people doing with all of those Android devices that they have? And I talked to a few people about this, and the general consensus is that a lot of smartphones are coming preloaded with Android, and there's likely a lot of people that don't even realize they're running Android or even understand the capabilities or the functionality that they have. They think they just have a phone and they're really not using the services. So, you know, it's great that you can have a large market share, but if people aren't using the functionality of your device, does it really matter all that much? They could be running any sort of operating system and it probably wouldn't matter. Another report from Statista offers an interesting perspective on Apple's profits. They compared Apple's 2012 profits as of this month versus other companies, and they found that for its fiscal year 2012, Apple has earned $41.7 billion. That's on $156.5 billion of revenue. But here's the interesting part. That number, $47.1 billion, is more than the combined profit of Microsoft, Google, eBay, Yahoo, Facebook, and Amazon for the same period. Let me say that again. Apple earned more so far this year than the combined net profit for Google, Microsoft, eBay, Yahoo, Facebook, and Amazon combined. Those companies together earned $34.4 billion. So Apple made $7 billion or has made $7 billion more than that just this year. If you look at the top PC manufacturers combined, that's Dell, Asus, Intel, Acer, IBM, Lenovo, and HP, they made $19.3 billion in profit for that period. That's less than half of what Apple has made so far. So that's just crazy to think about, especially considering that investors were overall disappointed with Apple's fourth quarter earnings, which came in slightly below analyst expectations. So even though they weren't happy with those numbers, Apple is blowing away the competition in terms of profit. And that means a healthy company. And a healthy company means good things for us because it means Apple's going to be around for a while making really great products. And not only that, they have money to invest in R&D and new technologies to sort of push things forward and do what they do. So that's just really cool. And then finally in the news for this week, one company that's going to be enjoying less and less of the benefits of Apple's success is Samsung. They are pretty much partner non grata at this point. If Apple could cut them off immediately, I think they would. With the continuing lawsuits, Apple and Samsung seem to be continuing to dissolve their relationship outside the courtroom. Reports say now that Apple has been pulling their display and solid state memory orders from Samsung as quickly as they possibly can, or probably more likely as the contracts begin to expire. They're just not renewing them. It's also been rumored that Samsung increased the price of Apple's processors 20%, a claim that Samsung has denied. The processor rumor came with rumors that Apple would be looking to actually remove their processor contracts from Samsung as well, possibly moving that manufacturing to Taiwan Semiconductor, although most people agree that that's not going to be very easy for Apple to do, and that transition is not going to come very quickly. It's expected to kind of happen throughout the period of next year. We'll have to see how that moves along, but the AX processor is likely going to be the last thing that Apple rips from Samsung's hands. There now comes word, though, that Samsung is no longer going to be supplying batteries for Apple. That has reportedly forced Apple to find some other battery suppliers, something that they reportedly have already kind of figured out. And Apple is already said to be relying more heavily on LG and AU Optronics for the majority of its fourth generation iPad and iPad mini displays. So, you know, it was always this sort of strange, incestuous relationship between Apple and Samsung. And now, of course, it seems they've reached the final and sort of ugly and logical demise of that relationship. It's really just blowing up. It's actually kind of calming down now a little bit. I think we're going to hear a little bit more about the continuing lawsuits, but pretty much Apple is moving on, and Samsung is as well. So kicking off the feedback portion of the show this week, I do want to make a quick comment about my move away from my grandfathered AT&T unlimited data. I told you a little bit on the last episode about why I moved away from that. If you're curious, you can go back and listen to that episode. But essentially what it came down to was I really needed a new data tethering option. The one I had been using, which was my pay-as-you-go Virgin mobile phone, it had become pretty much unusable in terms of the data speed. And with my new iPhone 5 and the incredible speed of LTE, I wanted to be able to take advantage of that. And when I went back and looked at the amount of data I was using on a consistent basis with AT&T, I was never going over that 2 gigabyte limit. And in order to get on the data pro plan that will allow you to do throttling, you get a 5 gigabyte limit. So I was figuring I'm not going to get anywhere close to that. And I can say after a few weeks of using it, I am super happy with my decision. I love the connection. When I need to get the tethering, I can flip it on. It works great. Occasionally, it takes a little while for my devices to recognize it. So I'm not sure what that's all about. Connecting to it can sometimes be a little bit tricky. But once it's on and working, it is fabulous. And so far, I haven't gotten anywhere near my data limit. And I've used it quite frequently. I use it about once or twice a week for tethering with my iPads, and I'm nowhere near the 3 gigabyte level yet. So, and I'm checking email. I'm not being very careful. I've even streamed some video in terms of looking at YouTube videos and what have you. So it's not really been a problem. About the only thing that I didn't realize is I thought as an added bonus, I was going to get access to the FaceTime over cellular, because we had seen all those reports that AT&T was finally going to allow FaceTime over cellular on plans that are not just the family share plans. The thing I didn't realize about that, and I found out this week after I got a listener question, was that FaceTime over cellular on AT&T's network, they announced that they were going to do it and extend that to the data pro plans and the non-family share plans, but that it was going to take 8 to 10 weeks before they rolled that out. So it's going to be a little while before we get that feature, probably not until next year, it looks like. Here's a cool little tip I saw this week over on Cult of Mac. As you likely know, iOS 6 Messages has iMessage, which allows you to forgo any of your cellular SMS data service, and you can send iMessages over Apple's network from one iMessage compatible machine or device to another. So things like iPhones or iPads or your Macs running Mountain Lion, for folks who have iMessage support, you get to get cheap messaging. And you can tell when you're using iMessage, because on the Messages app in the input box, it'll say iMessage, and then you'll also get a text bubble and a send button that's blue instead of green on your device. But what happens if you're sending over iMessage and the iMessage service isn't available? That happens on occasion. Sometimes your messages will stall out. They'll just sit there. You'll get the little error message, the little red icon that says it didn't make it. You can hit the send button in those cases, and if you see the sending status message and it still hasn't delivered that message yet, if you actually click and hold on the bubble, you'll get a little pop-up and you can choose to copy the text, or you'll notice there's another button that says send as text message. If you select that, it will send that message, it will turn green and send it as a standard SMS, and so you can force it to bypass the iMessage service. Again, the key to this is you need to do it before the message and its status change to delivered. Once it's been delivered, you're not going to see this option. A little bonus tip on iOS that I'll give you too that I found out about this week is there's a easy way to dismiss banner notifications that come down over the app that you're looking at. This tip actually came from something written up by Melissa Holt over on the Mac Observer. You know, sometimes you're in an application and the little banner notifications that come down from Notification Center, they can block buttons or controls for a second that are in the app that you're using. I've found this to be particularly annoying. I'll try and click on an interface element or something just under that banner notification and actually accidentally hit the banner notification itself, which will take me into the app, which is not what I want to do. So instead of waiting for that animation to run its course, if you need to get at those controls, what you can do is swipe from right to left across the banner notification, and that will immediately dismiss it, allowing you to get at the controls in the app that you're in. One caveat to dismissing the notification, though, that was noted by Melissa's piece is that if you're in a game, some games will actually pause as you're dismissing the notifications. So if you don't want to have your game accidentally paused, you might want to just wait for the banner notification to fade away naturally. But great tip. And it was funny because I was actually looking for something like that. It was annoying me enough that I was wondering how you could dismiss those a little more quickly. So again, hats off to Melissa over at Mac Observer. If you have one of the newer Macs that are now supporting USB 3 and you have a USB 3 external hard drive, this is something you might want to know about. An interesting Apple support article showed up this week, and it talks about USB 3 hard drives and interference with wireless signals. Specifically, it says that with USB 3.0, hard drives can emit radio frequencies that actually interfere with Wi-Fi and Bluetooth transmission in the 2.4 gigahertz band. What they recommend is that you don't place a USB 3 hard drive near the hinges on the screen of your MacBook Pro or your MacBook Air, or specifically behind the screen. I don't think the article addresses the new iMacs or Mac Minis yet, but ultimately the point is you probably want to keep your USB hard drives away from wherever the Wi-Fi antennas are in those models. Now, on the iMac, it's probably fine because I think it's up behind the Apple logo. Not sure on the Mini, but you probably don't want to set your USB 3 hard drive on top of your Mac Mini, for example. The interference, what it may do is just cause reduced data speeds and throughput, or worse, it could cause your wireless signals to drop out altogether. They also note that USB 3 devices should have good shielded cables that you connect with, because I guess you can also get interference coming through the cable connections. So make sure that it's shielded both on the cable and on the connectors. Since the interference is only in the 2.4 gigahertz range, I would imagine that another option might be to switch your Wi-Fi over to use the 5 gigahertz band. You could force it into 5 gigahertz. That, of course, is assuming that you have a dual band router, and also that if you have older devices, that you can separate those devices onto a 2.4 gigahertz network that is separate from the 5 gigahertz. But just something to be aware of now that we're getting more and more USB 3 support on the Mac. And Wi-Fi, I think, is just one of those tricky technologies that is getting more and more difficult to troubleshoot. As we get more and more devices that are entering our Wi-Fi networks, you have more and more things like USB 3 hard drives that can potentially cause interference. And a lot of times you end up with issues like this one that Brad is going through.
Hey, Adam. Brad over in West Michigan. Hey, man, I've got a problem that's got me baffled. And it has to do with syncing between my iPhone 4S and iTunes. Running the latest version of iOS, I think 6.01, on my iPhone 4S, and the latest version of iTunes, 10.7, on Mountain Lion. And basically what's happening is I can sync. If I initiate a sync between my phone and iTunes from my phone, it works every time. I just go, you know, into whatever, I think it's settings and general settings and Wi-Fi sync. It works great from there. But if I try to initiate it from iTunes, well, first of all, half the time my phone doesn't even show up on the sidebar in iTunes. And even if it does show up on the sidebar, when I click on sync, it will start to look for the phone, and eventually a message comes up and says, sorry, can't locate your phone, and the phone just disappears off the sidebar. I can go right back to my phone, initiate a wireless sync from the phone, and it works fine. So I'm kind of a little bit stumped on this one. You know, all the general stuff is, I think I have set up right. It's on the same Wi-Fi network. I don't have any weird firewalls or anything running. You know, I would think if it works one way, it would work the other, but I'm just trying to figure out what's the difference between, you know, syncing from iTunes versus the other way, and maybe what I've got going on that's wrong here. Any help would be much appreciated. Thanks, Adam. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Brad. I appreciate the question. And, you know, you're not the only one to point this out. As a matter of fact, you can tell that Brad sent this in before the iTunes 11 update, so it's possible that this is some issue with iTunes. Brad pointed me to an Apple discussion thread where others were reporting suffering from similar issues. So, of course, Brad, the first recommendation would be try iTunes 11, see if it doesn't resolve the issue. But you weren't the only one to email me about this problem either. I recently got some other emails or similar emails about Wi-Fi syncing and iTunes. And on occasion, I had similar issues where I would get errors or my device would suddenly go missing in the middle of a sync and you'd get these weird errors. Wi-Fi, as we were talking about, is really susceptible to interference, so you never really quite know. It's kind of tricky to troubleshoot. So a couple of the things that I would try, actually, let me back up. For those people who don't know that you can sync your iOS devices over Wi-Fi, that's been a feature that's been around for a while. The way you turn it on or enable it is you go into iTunes, you select your device in iTunes, and then go to the summary tab of the settings, and then there's a little checkbox that says sync this device over Wi-Fi. If you turn that on, that will enable the Wi-Fi syncing options. And then at that point, what should happen is when you plug your iOS device into power and you have it on the same Wi-Fi network as your Mac with iTunes running, then it will initiate a sync. And you can see that because it'll have a little spinning kind of arrow icon in the menu bar on your iOS device, and that's how you know it's syncing. If you want to force a manual sync, what you can do is you can go into the settings, and it doesn't matter if you're connected to power or not. You can go into Settings, General, under iTunes Wi-Fi Sync, and then tap on the Sync Now button. This is on your device, and it will sync your data and information wirelessly. And your Mac does need to be running with iTunes running for this feature to work. So Brad, getting back to your question and some troubleshooting, one of the first things that I would do is double check your Wi-Fi and your router, more specifically your router. And first and foremost, make sure that you're up to date on the software. If you're running an AirPort, then make sure that you've run software update and you've applied all the latest AirPort updates. If you're running a third-party router, you're going to want to go check with the manufacturer on their support site and just double check and make sure that they don't have a firmware update or a software update available. If they do, make sure you apply that, because as Apple updates the operating system, they tweak things with the Wi-Fi, and I've seen it where if your router is not completely up to date, it can sometimes cause weird problems like this where things get slow or you get dropouts, and that can happen. Now, in Brad's case, he had multiple devices and some were working and some weren't. So, Brad, this might not be your issue, but for everybody else, it's a good place to start troubleshooting. And the next thing would be to then also reset the router. Just completely power it down, power it back on is one method for most third-party routers. You can unplug them and plug them back in. If you have an AirPort, you can use the AirPort utility software either on your Mac or on iOS to go in, select the device, and reset it. And then doing a reset the same way on the device side could be a good thing too. So simply power off your device and then power it back on, or at the very least go into the Wi-Fi settings, turn off Wi-Fi or put it into airplane mode, let it sit there for a few seconds and turn it back on just so it gets a new connection to the network and see if the issues don't go away. If that doesn't work, the next step I'll usually do is a little more extreme, and that it would be to completely reset the network settings on your device. The way you do that is you go into Settings under General, you scroll all the way down to the bottom, you'll notice there's a reset button. Tap on that and then it'll give you a bunch of different options. The one you're looking for is Reset Network Settings. You're going to tap that button. If you have a passcode lock on your phone, it'll ask you to re-enter your passcode. It's also going to ask you to confirm that you want to reset the settings. And this is important because you're going to have to reconfigure everything after it runs the reset. So you'll have to re-enter your Wi-Fi password and reconnect to any known wireless networks that you access frequently. Again, re-entering the authentication passwords for those. So it's a little more hassle, but it does kind of set things back to factory specs and then wipes out any network settings that maybe got corrupted or something like that. So it's worth a try. Now, I know that I followed up with Brad via email and he tried resetting the network settings, tried resetting his router, and actually in his case, thing got a little bit worse. So this certainly wasn't the problem. That means it's kind of pointing back to maybe some issues with iTunes, the last version of iTunes. So it's probably worthwhile trying iTunes 11 and seeing if the bug is fixed in there. Brad, let us know if it is, But hopefully this will help some of you out with troubleshooting some of your Wi-Fi syncing issues with iTunes. Little bonus tip, kind of related to this, but more on the cellular data side, is if you're having trouble with weak cellular data signals, I've gotten in a situation where I'll be in an area, and it's usually an area that I frequent near my house or different places that I go, specifically at my house here in my office. I had a situation where I suddenly was getting really weak, like one bar signals from AT&T. And when I called up their support, they had me basically power off my device, leave it off for a few minutes, and then turn it back on. And I asked them, well, why are we doing that? And what they told me, and I'm not, I have to kind of take their word for it. So if you work in that industry, you can maybe let us know what's going on here. But basically said what happens with these devices is they can kind of lock on to a specific tower. So they find a signal when you power them on or when you're using them, and they kind of lock onto that. And when you come back to that area, it remembers that. So I take it to be kind of like the remember this network setting for wireless that we have on our devices. It'll always try and kind of reconnect to that same tower. But as network upgrades happen and they change out equipment and things like that, or if a specific tower and area is down, that might not be the best signal for you to connect to, but it might still connect to that and try and stay connected to it, even if it's weaker than a better signal. So you need to kind of just reset that connection, get it to find a better location. And the way you do that is basically by powering off the device. Now, in my case, I've been able to have it work by simply disconnecting from the cellular data network or disconnecting from the 3G network and reconnecting. So I go into settings, general, under cellular, turn off cellular data, wait about 30 seconds, or again, sometimes I'll put it in airplane mode because it's a little bit quicker. Put it in airplane mode, leave it there for 30 seconds, turn it back on. And then when I do that, it goes into that searching mode where it tries to find a network connection. I've seen situations where I have one bar, I literally haven't moved my location, do this procedure, and suddenly I have four bars. I've even had situations where I'll be on 3G with a really weak connection. I'll do this reset procedure with my iPhone 5, and then suddenly it finds the LTE network, and I've got a much better connection. If that doesn't work, you can do the more extreme thing of completely powering off your device. So hold the sleep wake button down, slide to power off, leave it off for a minute or two, and power it back on. If that doesn't work, they did tell me sometimes you have to leave the device off for 10 minutes. Again, I'm not a cellular data expert, so I don't know why you have to leave it off for so long. Something about the system sort of sweeping through and losing track of your device, basically, so that it's not on their network. And then when you reconnect, it'll get picked back up. But again, I'm just taking their word for it. It's worth a try anyway, especially if you find in particular areas you're getting slower than expected cellular connections. So lately, I seem to be having this rash of bad luck with some of my external hard drives, my backup drives, and most specifically and most recently with the drive that I use for my iTunes media. It failed. It started making a lot of really bad noise. It didn't fail completely, oddly. It was just making a lot of mechanical noise that are the kinds of things you don't want to hear coming from a hard drive. But I was still able to read data off of it. Every once in a while, it would stall out, and I'd have to kind of unplug it and reset it. But, you know, hard drives are, again, one of these things that have mechanical moving parts, and just after a certain period of time, they fail. So in my case, it's just that I have old drives, and it's probably time to replace them. I figure most hard drives you're going to get a lifespan, at worst, maybe about 3 years out of, at best, five. Once they get over 5 years, I start to worry about them a little bit. I have had drives that have lasted much longer than that, but 3 to 5 years is a pretty good time frame on a hard drive. And at that point, you probably want to bump up to something bigger anyway, and prices are always coming down. But my hard drive issues, coupled with a question that I received from Maggie, led me to decide that we need to talk a little bit. It's been a little while since we talked about hard drives. And specifically, Maggie had some questions. She is in need of a new hard drive. Has been using Western Digital drives and had some great success, but when she went to do research about buying a new one, she noticed that some of the reviews were indicating they needed a firmware update to work with Mountain Lion. And so she was wondering, do I go with this brand? How do I decide what to pick in terms of a hard drive? Do I need to worry about compatibility with the latest operating system, with the latest hardware? And in general, Maggie, you shouldn't have to worry about that. I know that Western Digital does some bundling of certain software with their drives, and they also have additional features like built-in encryption technologies and also built-in backup, like one-touch backup technologies. And I know that relies on some software that's usually pre-installed on the drive, so it may be that kind of thing that you need to update. I'm not aware of any firmware updates, but I wouldn't put it past a piece of technology. I mean, these things are sophisticated. They have sophisticated controllers and chips in them, so you may need to do that. What they might be specifically talking about, though, is their smartware software. There's also something called a virtual CD image that comes on a lot of them, where it's sort of partitioned with this image that is really difficult to remove. It's actually one of the reasons why I haven't been a fan of Western Digital drives. They do have instructions on their website for both uninstalling the smartware software, which is used for like backup and stuff like that. But if you're just using that drive as a Time Machine drive, you might not need the software technology that's built into the Western Digital drives. And the virtual CD thing is something that a lot of people don't want on there, and you can remove that as well. I'll have links to the support articles on their website for anybody who might want to get that stuff on off of there. But, you know, how do you decide on a hard drive and what and where to buy? And the way I make this decision, or tell people to make this decision most often, is to say, ask yourself this question: what do I need it for? What is the purpose of this drive? And that is going to really drive the answer to the rest of the questions. You know, is this drive for just nightly cloned backup, or is it something I need to increase performance? I want a new internal drive to make my machine faster, or I need additional storage and it's going to be the primary boot up drive for my system. And what you're going to use it for is going to factor into what kind of drive you get and how fast and what speed and how it needs to connect and all those sorts of things. But we'll go over the basics real quickly here. And then if you have additional questions, feel free to email me and I'll try and follow up. But in essence, you're going to have some basic questions you need to ask yourself. And first is, you know, do I need an internal or an external drive? And if it's external, you want to think about what kinds of connections you need to have. Can you get away with USB 2? Do you need USB 3? You know, do you have a shiny new iMac that uses USB 3 and you want to take advantage of that? FireWire 400 or 800 if you have an older system. eSATA is out there. Macs generally haven't supported, at least out of the box, eSATA, so that's not a common connector, but maybe you're working with a server or you have a specific need for eSATA. You might need to consider that. And of course, Thunderbolt is the big new one that a lot of us want to get for externals, because it's going to give you the best performance in a connector. On the internal side, you need to think about the speed of the SATA bus that you have, either 1.5, 3.0, or 6.0 gigabits per second, and that's going to depend upon which model Mac you have and how new it is. The good thing about the SATA connectors is they're generally backward compatible, so you can get a drive that supports a 6 gigabit SATA connection if you have a 1.5 SATA connector on your Mac. It's just going to run at the slower speed. But definitely going the other way, if you want best performance, you're going to want to make sure if you have a 6 gigabyte connection and you're getting a new SSD that you can take advantage of that. Form factor, either desktop or laptop drive, 3.5 inch versus 2.5 inch, that's pretty straightforward. And then budget comes into play. You know, how much do you want to spend based on how much storage you're going to get? And that becomes important because it might matter for what kind of drive you get, whether you get solid-state SSD, which is going to be much more expensive for less storage, or whether or not you go with a traditional spindle drive where you're going to get a lot more storage. So that is going to play into your other decisions. And finally, you have what kind of drive. Are you going to get a traditional drive where you get the most storage for your buck? Do you want the absolute fastest performance and you're going to go with SSD where price is no option? And with SSD, actually, prices are coming down pretty quickly, but still at a cost per gigabyte, it is much more expensive than a traditional spindle hard drive. And then you have technologies like hybrid technologies, which combine a traditional spindle drive with a little bit of flash memory or SSD memory for doing caching. And then you know now that Apple has their new Fusion drives, which give you the best of both worlds. They have about a $250 premium when you're doing a build-to-order option on a new Mac, and you're only going to be able to get those Fusion drives currently with a new iMac or a Mac Mini. Now, there are some ways that you can go kind of build your own Fusion drive if you want to get into that, and you can find those articles online. But Fusion is a neat technology, and I have a feeling we're going to see more companies coming out with similar technologies, and hopefully Apple will build that into disk utility where you can create your own Fusion drives if you buy an SSD and a spindle hard drive separately. Right now, Apple kind of puts them both into the same kind of enclosure, as far as I know, even though they're seen as separate drives. And then size, you know, if you're going with SSDs, you're looking at 30 gigabytes to maybe 960 gigabytes on the high end. That 960 gigabyte SSD drive is going to cost you probably around $1,200, so definitely not cheap. And with traditional hard drives, you got everything from 250 megabytes up to 4 gigabytes. Speed, generally in looking at speed for hard drives, you want to look at the throughput number. That's going to be the one that's going to matter the most. And by throughput, I mean it's going to be that stat that's large sequential read and write speeds. So how fast can you read and write to that disk? And then you also need to take into consideration, along with that, what kind of connection you have and the speed of that connection. So if you're using USB 3, are you going to be bottlenecked by that? Or USB 2, excuse me, are you going to be bottlenecked by that? If you're going to Thunderbolt, you're going to get much better performance. Or on the internal side, are you going to be limited by the speed of your SATA bus? It makes no sense if you have a 1.5 gigabit per second SATA connection to have a drive that's going to push 6 gigabits on the throughput. You're not going to be able to get it. You're going to be throttled at 1.5. Generally, you're not going to have to worry about that, but it's something to pay attention to. And caching, you're going to hear, you know, that thrown out there. This has 8 megabytes of cache, 16, you know, there's different cache sizes that you can get, particularly on spindle hard drives. In general, it doesn't matter too much, but in that case, always more is better. More caching is better. It's going to give you a little bit better performance. And if you really want to see some good performance numbers, check out Barefeats, BareFeats.com. They do benchmarking for Macs and graphics cards and hard drives and all that stuff. They do a really nice job, and they can show you some numbers comparing different kinds of externals and internals, and they just did a really nice report on the Fusion drives and performance on the new iMacs and stuff like that. So check that out. And then, you know, at the end of the day, after you've sort of decided on all these decisions, you're going to get down to brand. And brand, in my opinion, it really comes down to personal choice. I've always been a fan of Seagate drives. They've gotten a bad rap of late, but I've never really had a problem with them. A lot of people really like Western Digital. Toshiba's out there. The reality is there are really only a handful of manufacturers who actually make the raw drives and chips. So you've got Seagate, Toshiba, and Western Digital on the traditional spindle hard drive side of things. With SSD, you've got Intel and Samsung making chips, along with a few other companies. And then the rest of it really comes down to the assembly and manufacturing of the enclosure and those sorts of things. So bottom line is you probably want to check reviews. You want to go with your gut, things you've had success with in the past. Go with good, well-known suppliers of hard drives. OWC makes really nice drives and enclosures. That's at maxsales.com. I really like their products. I buy a lot of my external drives from them. Also, again, name brands like Seagate and Western Digital are generally pretty safe. And consider the warranty that comes with a drive. And that really does kind of give you at least an initial indication of what the manufacturer expects the quality of that drive to be. And different manufacturers have different levels. You know, Seagate has drives with 1-year warranties, 3-year warranties, and 5-year warranties. The 1-year warranty, they expect that maybe after a year, that drive might fail. So consider that when you're looking at the drives. I try and get drives with at least a 3-year warranty. If you can get 5, that's getting harder and harder to do, but that's a good thing. And beyond that, even if you get a warranty, you want to make sure you go with a company that it has good support. So what happens when you need a replacement drive? And just for an example, one of the reasons I like Seagate is that they do a pretty good job of giving you a replacement drive. I can use their expedited replacement service, which means I go on their website, I tell them I have a problem with my drive, here's the serial number. As long as it's under warranty, I can request a replacement, and I can have that replacement along with a shipping box shipped to me first. I can transfer over my data and get that all set up, make sure it's working, and then send them back the old drive that is bad. One thing to be aware of with most warranty replacement programs, though, is that they do not generally send you a brand new drive. What you get as a replacement drive is a refurbished drive. That's just how the system works. You send back your old drive, they'll use parts and components. This is very similar to what Apple does with iPhones and iOS devices. So it's pretty common industry practice, and I've never really had a problem with it. But consider what's going to happen when you need to take advantage of that warranty as part of the buying process. So I know this doesn't answer all the questions as much as give you some questions that you need to ask yourself, but I think it will help you make an informed decision when it comes time to go buy a hard drive. And I hope, Maggie, that helps you make your decision, and good luck. I noticed something this past week that is a little bit, or was a little bit annoying and potentially embarrassing with relation to the alert sounds and the ringer on my iPhone. And I don't think this was something that was introduced in iOS 6, but I only recently noticed it. And that was that even when I would have the volume on my device turned all the way down, so I'd use the volume buttons to turn it all the way down to zero, I would be getting alert and notification sounds specifically from Notification Center. They would come through and I would hear them regardless. And what I had not realized was that in iOS, there are separate volume controls for your alert sounds and ringer sounds. So if you go into General Settings and Sounds, what you'll see is that there is a volume slider in there for ringer and alert volume. And this may have come about for me because I might have done a reset on my phone at some point and forgotten that I had actually set a toggle that's in the same settings area. If you look under that slider, there's a toggle that allows you to set the volume buttons to also control your ringer and alert volumes. And my guess is that I had that turned on at one point and then suddenly I had it turned off, and now I was getting the situation where even though the volume for a particular app would be all the way down, so say a game or something that I was doing, it would not adjust the ringer and alert volume. That was at its own level, and it stays at its own level. So you can play around with these settings and get them the way that you like them. One thing you need to know about this is even if you enable this switch, you cannot turn the volume button on your device all the way down to zero. You have to use the slide switch to completely turn off, or the side switch, excuse me, to completely turn off ringer and alert volumes. What it'll do is it'll let you turn it down using the volume controls, but only all the way down to one. You cannot get it down to zero. You need to use the mute switch on the side of your device. And if you're in an app that has audio and it's currently playing, it will use the buttons to adjust the volume. So that sort of supersedes any of the alert and ringer volume adjustments when you have the allow volume buttons to control ringer alert volumes set to on. So just be aware of that. And in the case of the volume itself, that actually can be reduced all the way down to zero, but it will not change or adjust the alert and ringer volumes. So those two volumes are set separately. Even if you attach them to both be controlled by the physical buttons, it depends on what mode you're in. And you can tell which volume you're setting because when you press the buttons, if it says ringer on the little pop-up that comes up, then you know you're adjusting the ringer and alert volumes. If it doesn't say that, it means you're adjusting the main volume of the device itself. And so related to this conversation, I thought it would be good to know, okay, on the side switch, the little mute switch that's on the side, when you turn that to silent, it doesn't necessarily silence everything. So the things that it does not silence are alarms from the clock app, which is a good thing because if you set an alarm and want to be woken up in the morning, you can turn that to silent and you'll still get the alarm in the morning. Same thing on timers in the clock app. Also, audio from your music or video applications, that does not get muted. That's controlled by the separate volume. And of course, you can use the volume rockers to turn that all the way down to zero, and then it'll be off. But the silent switch does not control that stuff. Same thing for some third-party audio apps like streaming radio apps or video apps or music apps. I noticed this with YouTube. I'll have my volume or slider turned off, or the little rocker turned off on the side of the phone, and I will still be able to listen to YouTube videos. Or worse, when you're browsing the web, right, and you hit a video or something, it might come up in autoplay. That sound comes through. So you need to make sure that you turn your volume down on those. Tones also, when you're doing settings, so things like adjusting your ringer settings, picking a new ringtone, those will ring through even if you have the silent switch set. And I've seen people who try to adjust their ringtone when they're in silent mode, and you get caught off guard by that. Same thing for tones when changing the volume of the ringer alerts, the thing we were just talking about in the sound settings. When you adjust that, it does ring when you use the slider, and that will ring through even if you have the mute switch set. And also Find My iPhone service. If you send an alert to Find Your iPhone, that will ring through no matter what, regardless of what that switch setting does. So what exactly does it mute? It will mute your phone and call ringtones. It also suppresses text messaging tones and alert notifications. Also your calendar alerts, any reminder alerts, the camera snapping sound in the camera application, except in Japan. They actually have a law that will not allow you to mute that sound. And then also your game music. And this was the one that threw me off, because I would be in a game and I would have the mute switch set and thinking, oh, everything's fine, it's completely muted. And then occasionally I would still get sounds coming through and I couldn't figure it out. So that's why, and hopefully that helps demystify things for you. It certainly gave me a little education in how the different volumes and mute settings work on my iPhone. Lewis sent me an email this week, and he has an interesting situation with his wife's Mac. Suddenly, her Mac started to auto-log her out and require her to re-log into her Mac when she was waking from sleep, and he really wasn't sure why. And I thought about this for a little bit, Lewis, and it could be a bug or an issue with OS X, but I don't think it is. I think what possibly happened is you might try checking the security settings. Maybe they got reset somehow. I'm not entirely certain how. My one guess would be that maybe if you enabled File Vault recently, it may have turned on a feature that would cause the Mac to auto log out, because in order for File Vault protection to be on, you need to be logged out of your account. Once you're logged in, it's going to put in the keys and stuff to unlock or give access to the encrypted hard drive, and so you're not necessarily protected at that point. You need to be logged out for the protection to be on fully. So where you probably want to look is you want to go into System Preferences under Security and then go into the General tab. You'll probably have to click on the little lock icon and enter your admin username and passwords to allow changes for the security settings, and then click on the Advanced button. And in that little dialog that pops up, you should see a setting that says log out after X number of minutes of inactivity. Make sure that that is not checked. You can uncheck it to make sure that it's completely disabled. If it's checked, then you know why it's logging out. You could also just adjust the amount of time. So maybe it's just logging out too quickly. You could set it for a longer amount of time before it does auto log out if you need to use this feature, if it was enabled by File Vault. But that's my guess as to what's happening. The other question I would have is she actually being 100% logged out of her account? Or is it the kind of thing where it goes to sleep into display sleep, for example, and then when you wake from sleep, it's actually asking for a password because it has a screen lock on? I actually like to have a screen lock on my Mac so that if I walk away and come back, you have to, you know, log in to get back into it. Someone can't just walk up to the machine and mess with it. So the way you can check this setting is you go into System Preferences, again into Security, again click on the General tab, and then look for the setting that says Require Password for Sleep and Screensaver. And if that is set and turned on and has a password, then it's going to prompt you for a password when waking from sleep. So it might be one of these two issues. If that's not it, shoot me a follow-up email and we'll try and troubleshoot it a little bit further. But I have a feeling that's what's going on. And then the last thing I have for you today is a cool little trick, a little Easter egg that was discovered again by the folks over at Mac Observer, actually Dave Hamilton, because he's kind of a Unix geek. This one goes back to the Unix roots of Mac OS X, specifically the BSD core. But, you know, the new Hobbit movie is coming out in just a couple weeks. I'm getting very excited about that in December, and this one is related to that. It can get you kind of up to speed on your Hobbit lore with this little terminal hack. What you do is you go into the terminal, so go into Applications Utilities, launch the terminal, and then at the command prompt, you type the command cat, C-A-T, space, and then you're going to put in a path, and the path is /USR for user, /share, S-H-A-R-E, /calendar, /calendar.lotr, Lord of the Rings, and then hit enter. And then it will spit back and display to you a timeline of Middle Earth history, or a timeline of different events in the stories. And it's pretty cool. And in case you're wondering, the cat command, it's a relatively benign command in Unix. It's not going to do anything nefarious to your system. It's just a Unix way to display the contents of any file that you pointed at. So basically you're saying, show me the contents of the calendar.lotr file. And I thought that was really cool. And it's been around in Unix for years. You know, it's just something that you can go into almost any Unix system and see. But Dave was apt to point it out specifically now with the new movie coming out. So that's everything that I have for you for today, or for this week. I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook and iTrash. You can get more information on their software as well as free trials over at circusponies.com. Smile, be sure to check out Text Expander, Disk Label, PDF Pen, also Text Expander Touch, and PDF Pen for the iPad and iPhone. You can get more information on their software as well as free trials of their Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, if you want to get cash for some of those old iOS devices, your old Macs before the holiday season, you can go to gazelle.com and see how much your products are worth and get a cash offer. And Go To Meeting with HT Faces from Citrix, great way to meet and collaborate online. Just visit gotomeeting.com for a free 30-day trial, and be sure to use the code MACCAST when you sign up. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Big thank you to you for your support. If you have any questions for me, a comment, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. The Skype address is the MACCAST. If you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MACCAST, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. Be sure to check out the forum while you're there, forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, and over on Facebook, facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.